I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, folks. Before we start today's episode of the Chase Thomas Podcast, I'd just like to remind you guys that you can check out my daily sports column. It's free by going to sportsrenaissanceman.substack.com. You can just check out my Twitter to find the link there. Go check out chasethomaspodcast.com. There's a link on that page. But yeah, go check it out every day. New sports story in your email inbox. Go tell a friend, share it out, send it to anyone else you think would like the newsletter. But yes, every single day, go to sportsrenaissanceman.substack.com. Just Google Sports Renaissance Man, Chase Thomas, whatever you're most comfortable with, go do that. If you are an Apple Podcast listener, don't forget to leave this show a 5-star rating and a review. It's important to help the show continue to grow. And last thing, very quickly, but please email me at chasethomaspodcast@gmail.com to get your mailbag question in or any other questions that you might have about the show, about the column, anything like that. New mailbag columns go up every Friday. If you have any questions for the weekly shows that you would like us to answer on air, whether it's John Taylor on Wednesdays, Evan Swords on Mondays, the sports reporters on Fridays, make sure to get those questions in and we'll read them on the show, or I'll answer your questions in the mailbag on the newsletter. So go do that. Again, that's chasethomaspodcast@gmail.com. Leave the show a 5-star rating and review. Follow on Apple Podcasts if you can. I think that's it. All right, Uncle Darren, let's go.
Chase Thomas Podcast. The Chase Thomas Podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, the Atlanta sports guys, we have reassembled because it is Friday afternoon, where I am joined, as I am every single Friday, by Max Markovich down there in Atlanta, and also Garrett Chapman. Guys, how are we doing this evening?
Good, man. Good. It's a great day. I have a day off finally, and obviously, because always this happens, it's an overcast. I was going to go up to the pool at my new place, and I was like, yes, finally, let's go. Can't get up there.
Are you a pool guy?
Sometimes. I'm very pale, so I gotta go when I can.
Person, I assume the fair skin aspect does not bode well at the pool.
No, actually, honestly, the overcast might do me some good. I go with friends normally, and if they're coming, then I'll go. And then I'm like a puppy. I'm good with groups. I just enjoy those.
You're good with groups.
I love groups.
Interesting.
Large parties. I love them.
Max, are you a group person?
I'm a group person. I'm also a pool person, but last weekend I got a sunburn at the pool last weekend that if the photo ever leaks, like, I don't think I can ever show myself in public. It's bad.
Where was it?
It's just on my friend's pool, like rooftop, and I was just laying out and I got negligent.
I'm saying location wise, where was the burn?
Front half of my body. chest, stomach, the whole thing.
Oh god, I've had some pretty bad burns in my lifetime. Oh god, I once fell asleep face down on the beach around midday down in Destin, Florida. Fell asleep for like 3 hours on the beach and nobody thought to wake me up before I for sunscreen or anything, woke up at about like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I said, oh no, I could feel it all down my back. I couldn't walk, man. I don't know if you've ever had the backs of your knees burn before, but it is quite possibly the least pleasant experience of my life.
Tops of the feet are like also underratedly horrible.
Oh yeah. And if you get your ears, then they start itching and it's, oh God.
See, I hate y'all burn a lot. Y'all are very versed.
Bro, I'm pale.
I'm extremely pale too. Like, I'm fair skinned. That's why I was so annoyed last month in Jacksonville when I got burned, is I was SPF 50 and I was like very careful, reapplied, did everything, and I still burned and I peeled.
You're the kind of guy who applies sunscreen like 4 or 5 times though.
I heard a conspiracy theory that and anything over SPF 30 is just all the same. It's just
I heard that too.
It's like an old wives tale. It wouldn't surprise me. Like, there has to be a
tipping
point.
I can't verify, but
there has to be.
The dude at the supermarket said it was true, so it has to be true, right?
I don't know.
That's what I heard, actually.
Yeah. I got over it. Like, that was something. Isn't it weird? Like, when you're younger, it's like, it's not cool to have SPF 50, or it's like, it's not cool to protect yourself from the sun. It's like one of the dumber things we all do as kids. It's just like, is that dude putting on sunscreen to prepare himself for the? What a loser.
No, dude, I need the sunscreen. If I don't have the sunscreen, I burn so badly. Oh God, it's so bad. I haven't had a sunburn, like a bad sunburn though, in a while. It's been a long time.
Yeah, I get nervous about it. I don't know. I feel like sun cancer runs in my family, so like I don't know. I'd rather avoid it at all costs. So I even run in long sleeves now with how hot it is right now. Like, I have never sweat so much in my runs than I have in the last week. Like, it is so humid and so hot here in Knoxville. I don't know what it's like in Atlanta right now, but I am getting drenched in my runs right now. And I don't.
It's because you turned 30.
Okay, well, it's not because of that. I don't think.
Wait, did you say you wear long sleeves when you run?
Mm-hmm. That's why also.
Dude, how do you survive?
Well, I have to. Like, I don't want to burn my air. Like, I wear it with the hat, the long sleeves, and shorts. My legs are accustomed to the sun, so my legs actually tan pretty nicely. But, like, outside of that, I cover everything else up.
How long are your runs?
About 20, 25 minutes, 3.5 miles.
I don't think I've ever burned in that amount of time.
It's not even like I'll burn. I just in case. Like, you can never be too cautious. Sun's not my friend, man.
Oh man, you sound like the kid from Benchwarmers. You remember that movie?
I know, that was the callback.
I was scared of the sun.
Yeah, sun's not my friend. It wasn't his friend. It wasn't my friend. And people say that I remind them a lot of Nick Swartzen in all kinds of contexts.
is that his name?
Nick Swartzen. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, have you ever watched any of his stand-ups?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I actually I probably have. I probably have. Now that I'm thinking about it.
They're good. He has some good ones. He's also like a super Minnesota fan. I think he's like a gigantic diehard Vikings fan. Speaking of the NFL, guys, we are going to start our weekly preview series, positional preview series for our Atlanta Falcons as training camp ramps up in 2.5 weeks. What is it? It's July 31st. So what are we? It's July 15th. So 16th. Yeah, 2 weeks. Which I'm excited about. It's almost here, training camp right around the corner during this NFL dead period. But we're going to start on the defensive side of the ball that will be coached by DMPs. And I'm curious to know if you guys even do y'all know who the current OC is off the top of your head? Could you shout out his name?
He was the Bears passing game coordinator.
Yeah, Doug Ragone. No, what's his name?
Oh shit!
Isn't this wild?
Immediately.
I look it up almost every day because I'm like, who is it again? It's Dave Ragone.
Ragone, right? Yeah.
Ragone, okay. Yeah.
You said Doug. Doug.
Oh, yeah.
I said Doug. Come on. It's July 15th. Offensive man had a great run. I don't know.
I just have been so tuned out ever since the draft. I've just been sort of – I haven't really thought about the Falcons like at all until you're like, let's do a Falcons secondary like thing. I'm like,
yeah.
Okay. I'm a writer for the Falcons. I just haven't thought about them for like a month.
Y'all been way too invested in the Hawks at this point. You were like, oh, they might go to the finals. Remember when there was someone in this pod who was like, they're probably going to the finals? And I was like,
dude, they would have gone.
If Trae Young was healthy, this team would be playing in the NBA finals.
I don't think you can say that.
You can't drag me for that take a month before the playoffs saying they might be able to make the finals when they like no one.
They came two games away. No one expected that except for Markovic over there.
I'm gonna do it anyway. It's my show. My name's on the show. My name is on the show. Drag whoever I want, whenever I want. That's how this works now. I think I'm excited because I just think the reason maybe the Falcons have popped back in my mind is just that PFF had a really good piece outlining like why the Falcons are a high floor, low ceiling team in 2021, which I think is interesting. Around the league, everyone just expects like 7-10, 8-8. I got to get these numbers right because of the 17 game season now, but like 8-9, like they're somewhere in that window, but it's very unlikely that they do another 4-12 season. And I think I agree with that by and large, even after trading Julio, but I do think it's interesting because so much is riding on them keeping it moving because Terry Fontenot was on the NFL show with Robert Mays and talking about like they rebuild is not in their dictionary, like in their vocabulary, what have you. And I think that's fascinating. And I think he is the right man to kind of navigate those waters because of where he came in New Orleans, where the salary cap doesn't matter. And they just keep punting on rebuilding and finding money for Ryan Ramczyk. And just that like the Saints have floated this tightrope or walked this tightrope for several years now. And the Falcons are going to have to do the same thing with an aging Matt Ryan. So I'm fascinated to see how he does all of this and gets the cap not right, because if he gets the cap right, you can't just like be in the middle ground. Like you can't do that. You have to find ways around it. And I think it's just going to be fascinating to look, because on defense is where a lot of these questions are going to pop up with Grady Jarrett getting paid. You have Dante Fowler being gone probably up to this year. You have the Deion Jones question. You have the Foye Olukun, how much do they value him? AJ Terrell will eventually come up for an extension. Like there's names across this roster where I'm curious to see how this all unfolds. But the secondary, a lot of change, man. Keanu Neal, not there. No Keanu Neal. No Ricardo Allen, just some new faces. And I think it's going to be fascinating because right now you have Richie Grant coming in, you have Daron Harmon coming in, but there's a chance that Jalen Hawkins, the fourth rounder from 2020, gets one of those starting spots. You got Eric Harris, the other safety spot. So I'm interested in that. I'm interested in Isaiah Oliver and where he's at, because AJ Terrell, he flashed some superstar stuff last year. I think AJ Terrell is going to look like a good pick. Going forward. And then you have Kendall Sheffield, who I'm not all the way in on. Like, I'm not a big, but then you draft Darren Hall in the fourth round. So they've spent a lot of draft capital, and then Avery Williams, who's going to specialize in the return game, the fifth. Like, they've invested a lot of resources this offseason in rebuilding that secondary. So I think it'd be fun to start here. Garrett, when you look at this group and what Fontenot has assembled so far and what the leftovers were from the Dimitroff era, what do you see?
Well, I mean, this secondary, if you have one quarterback who basically amassed like whatever statistics they led up last year, 4,700 yards, 34 touchdowns, he's going to the Pro Bowl. That's how bad this group was last year. I mean, I think they gave up more passing yards than the LA Rams gave up in total yards. I mean, this group is just not very good. But a lot of that had to do with like, that came in like with the Dak Prescott game, where they were trying to come from behind with the Bears game. They were coming from behind. So I think that had a lot to do with it. But this group was bad, but it was also young. And I think it's going to be, again, pretty young this year. I do really like the additions they have at safety. Eric Harris and Daron Harmon both were our big locker room guys. I mean, they're both in their early 30s. I think they're both 30, 31 years old. They're solid players. You know what you're going to get. They're not going to be anything too flashy. They're not going to be Pro Bowlers or anything. But I think both were captains last year for their respective teams. I mean, Daron Harmon got traded from the Patriots to the Lions and then immediately became a critical locker room presence. And I think that's going to be very important for this group, especially with the young Jalen Hawkins and Richie Grant. I'm huge on Richie Grant. I think he is an absolute steal. Getting him in the second round, he was a first round talent to me. So when we were able to get him in the early second round, I thought that was huge for this defense, especially for Dean Pease's defense. And I think I honestly think this defense or this secondary is going to be a lot of, like, I think it's going to improve. But I think it's going to improve as a functionality of the S of the pass rush, which, I mean, honestly, I swear to God, we've been talking about the pass rush for the better part of two decades. ever since we lost John Abraham. We really had, and even before that, I mean, like we just haven't had anything from the pass rush. But if we can get a little bit more pressure on the quarterback, I think this secondary is really going to flourish, especially with the youth on the outside.
Max, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think off the bat, we need to frame this conversation with, like we're going to say some good things, some bad things, but PFF ranked all 32 NFL secondaries coming into 2021, and the Falcons were 32nd, which is last. Yeah, so I think you need to start there, right? Like, we can say we are excited about A.J. Terrell, which I am. I can say I'm cautiously high on what Kendall Sheffield could be, which I am. But, like, the ceiling of the secondary is probably like still slightly below average. It's not a matter of like whether I'm okay with it. It's just sort of a matter of, the previous regime poured resources. And this is sort of the story of the Falcons, is like the previous regime poured resources into the top of the roster. They paid the top of the roster. It almost won them a Super Bowl, which we need to continue to point out. And that came at the expense of, nickel and diming in other places. And so when you can't afford to keep Keanu Neal and Ricardo Allen, and you basically have to hit the reset, I don't hate the way they hit the reset, right? Like, I like the Daron Harmon signing. I like, Eric Harris enough. And I like the Richie Grant pick. But there's not a ton here to suggest this is going to be like a good secondary this year or probably in the next couple of years. But I also think part of the game plan here is for DNP's scheme to sort of mask a few of these weaknesses.
Yeah. I think that's important to point out too, yeah. Right? Like, that's the reason for optimism is the DNP's addition and what he does and like what his track record is here. So even if the sum of the parts aren't great, it's maybe on talent they're 32nd, but with what DNP's is able to scheme up, they can flirt with that mid-20s space.
Right. And the long-term, like, if you want to be an optimist about this, the long-term trajectory of the secondary could be pretty good. Like, if you hit on Isaiah Oliver and Kendall Sheffield in particular, and then obviously AJ Terrell becomes what I think we all think AJ Terrell will be, and Richie Grant is a starting caliber safety. Like, that's a really good, young, cheap place to start. And so long term, like, I would say this is not my biggest concern for position groups with the Falcons. It's probably not even top two or three. Short term, I don't see it being good this year, but I also don't. Like, this defense doesn't need to be good to be a better football team than last year, to be a winning football team this year. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about that, I think, a lot more when we talk about the offense. But, like, you just need to be passable. And that could be possible.
I mean, if you get this group into the top 20, I think Dean Pease is going to get this to the low 20s, maybe like 20 to 25 range. But if he can get better than that, like, even just like generate some turnovers. I don't know, get after the quarterback. I mean, I think you do that, and then the secondary is going to just flourish. But if you can get it to like the just around the average mark, I think that's a huge accomplishment for Dean Pease in this defense. And I think he might be able to do that. I don't know, but we might have some – maybe that's not realistic, but maybe it's just me being a hopeless optimist about this defense, but I don't know.
Who do you think gets the most snaps among the two safety spots?
Daron Harmon, probably. He's the guy I would point to specifically. But, I mean, they're also going to want to come and bring in Richie Grant and Jalen. I mean, I think it's just going to be – it just depends on what Dean Pease does, because Dean Pease, the thing that I'm most fascinated with him about is that he can just sort of align his schemes with whatever he has. Mm-hmm. And he can do that on a week-to-week basis. And he showed he did that. He did that in Tennessee, and he made that defense top 10, top 15 defense. And then as soon as he leaves, it drops to like the 26th ranked defense. I mean, he's shown that he can do more with less. And I think he's going to do that this year. I firmly believe that, because he has the ability to, he's just malleable. I mean, he can adjust and he can do it on the fly. To answer your question, I don't know. It could change on a weekly basis.
Yeah. When they signed, Harmon and Harris, I think that was before the draft. I think we sort of had a little bit of a text conversation being like, is this the plan at safety? Cause that's a little, but I think their plan here is sound, right? Like, they didn't have the cap space to go out and make a splash at safety. So they got two hopefully solid veteran options along with Jalen Hawkins, with the hope that the guy they draft, they bring in a young guy with the hope that he can eventually work his way in and become a starter.
Yeah, you don't want to throw them to the fire. Like, you want to have the mixture where like you don't have to give him all those reps. And
you don't
want
to come into training camp day one and say, Richie Grant, save us here. Because that's just not a healthy way to bring a rookie into the fold right away to a secondary that's not very good.
And that's what Terrell had to deal with last year. We should mention, like, Terrell had to deal with that a lot last year.
Yeah, I mean, he was out there guarding the best, you know, opposing receivers.
It's already one of the most difficult positions on the football field, because you're out on an island half the time, and they showed a complete lack of willingness to adjust to anything. And
I mean, look at Akuda. He went number three last year, and he was, like, I think PFF's maybe worst graded corner in football last year, and they were just watching tape of him. Akuda was getting destroyed.
Oh no, we were just getting slaughtered. I mean, like, we were just in terrible position just constantly.
And that's why I think there's been this sort of, like, weird, if you guys have reached the national conversations around AJ Terrell and sort of around football circles, has just been kind of a little bit down on him. And then every Falcons fan who watches him play is like, wait, no, like, y'all don't get it. Like, he was really good last year. And, like, the fact that he stayed afloat is a huge accomplishment.
Yeah. I mean, he was young. I mean, everyone just pointed to that LSU game. Just like, see, so told you so. It's like, no, what are you talking about?
No, Terrell, the guy, and I think he has the talent. I like Terrell a lot. I was a little bit dubious of the pick because of just, like, my reason I was dubious about the pick last year was that I just thought so much was going into last year being a Super Bowl run. Like, they needed so much. They needed somebody in the cornerback position. Is kind of like the point guard position in basketball, where it seems like you need a couple years and you're just going to be bad as you figure stuff out, and you get burned and you get torched, and you have to adjust. But the Falcons didn't really have time to adjust with Julio potentially being it, and just the amount of resources poured into that team that, like, this was a do or die year. So you do a do or die year with CeeDee Lamb. Like, you just hope that you score enough with that trio that it doesn't matter what's happening on defense. And then, because, like, by the time AJ Terrell is good, it's a new regime. And that's what happened ultimately.
I also think sort of like my macro Falcons take here applies to the defense too, which is that, like, there's going to be this, like, sort of undercurrent of, like, this team, you know, the roster is not very good. But I think we saw last year, sort of in the second half of the year when Raheem Morris took over, that, like, the defense can be fine. Mm-hmm. You know, the talent on the roster is not great. I don't think on the defense. I don't think anyone would say it's, like, a really loaded defense. But, like, it's not. It's also not, like, a bottom three defense in the NFL. And I think with, like, some basic coaching upgrades on both sides of the ball, the floor of this team is just going to be so much higher. And I think the Julio trade really just, like, soured everyone on the Falcons in general, in a way that I think was a huge overreaction to where this team actually is.
I think that's fair. Garrett, your standout pick, who do you think grades the best among the safeties and corners for PFF this fall? Who do you think ends up being the highest graded Falcons secondary player?
I think it's Richie Grant. Hmm. I think he's gonna be a guy who's gonna come in and sort of make a splash. I mean, he was a redshirt senior down at UCF, and he's been on the radar since, like, his sophomore year. I mean, the guy's a stud. I mean, he can do it all. He can clean up. He tackles effectively. He can get after. He's a ball hawk. I think he's gonna show up on the stat sheet. Now, the only thing holding him back, honestly, he may just not get enough snaps. But I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm going to say Richie Grant, because that's how high I am on Richie Grant right now.
Well, we've seen those impacts. Jonathan Abram was like that in Oakland a couple of years ago before he got injured in that Monday Night Football game. Like, I think it's easier for safeties to adapt quicker than it is for corners.
Well, because you bring him in and just let him do his thing. I mean, the guy's an athlete. And so it's like, basically what you do is he's just a plug and play. Read the quarterback's eyes, figure it out, and then just do it. It's because it's not exactly like an AJ Terrell situation from a year ago, where you have to figure out schematics and your footwork, your everything, and then you're going up one on one against the best of the best of the best. No, I mean, being a safety, it's a little bit easier of a transition, I think. But I could see it. I could see it. I just think he's I'm just very high on him. So Richie Grant, that's who I'm gonna roll with.
What about you, Max?
I'm cautiously optimistic on all of the corners, actually. I think this will be the year that the Terrell kind of sort of like becomes like the Calvin Ridley of the defense, like sort of that career trajectory where it's like, oh, this guy will be a number one corner for us for a while. And I think that will be like very reassuring as like sort of a steady anchor for the defense in general, but definitely for the secondary. I'm going to stay high. I know this is a make or break year for Kendall Sheffield, but I believe in that talent. And I think he's shown flashes to the point where I think he's a good football player. And I think if he stays healthy, he'll have the chance to prove that. And I think Fabian Moreau will be.
Oh, that was my pick.
A guy, I was going to say, I think he'll be a guy similar where it's like, we didn't talk about this guy all offseason.
The Darqueze Dennard.
The Darqueze Dennard, where it's like, we didn't talk about him all year, but we just like feel super comfortable with him and can't imagine the secondary without him type of thing. So I like all three of those guys. I think Terrell will be the highest graded.
If Terrell is the highest graded, it's going to be a good year. Like if Terrell is an elite shutdown corner, that's a game changer. And that gets them out of the 32nd spot. Cause, I don't know if you guys knew this or not, but this division has a lot of top end receiver talent and the NFC as a whole has a lot of top end talent. So having somebody like Terrell, is good. The Braves.
Well, actually real quick.
Oh yes.
One last thing. Avery Williams.
Mm-hmm.
Did you guys read much about him during the draft process?
A little bit.
He could also be like one of the sneaky picks, but not because of his play on defense. It's just because I could theoretically see this guy playing all three phases. So he could come in and be a slot receiver if we needed him to be. He's going to be a return specialist. He's going to be a cornerback too. So he's a guy I'm very interested to watch. He's going to be like one of those like Swiss Army knife kind of guys. I don't know how good he is necessarily as a pure cornerback, but or just even as a safety or whatever position he's going to come in and play. I think he's going to come in and play a cornerback, but I don't know, just an interesting name to throw out there just to keep an eye on him.
Also, the idea that we're going to get Cordero and Avery Williams turning
kids. That's going to be a great combo. Avery Williams had like 10, I think he had 10 punt return or punt slash kick return for returns for touchdown in like one season or something like that. The guy's an animal. He's so good for Boise State the past couple of years.
I'm about it. The Braves made a trade last night, guys. Like the Braves did what I was hoping they would do. They traded. They didn't buy. Like this is the thing. It's like you have to frame it correctly, and it's not buying. Like Jock Peterson is not saving their season, but it's what they should do. It's a good thing for the fans. Like if they had just traded Charlie Morton, traded Drew Smyly, traded Will Smith, and just moved on, it just would have been an abject disaster and admitting failure and just a bad look for this franchise that's still within reach because the Mets clearly don't want to win the NL East. It's there. So like the idea that you can still push for the playoffs and win the NL East is still a possibility, and you can go after people that you could still theoretically keep in your outfield long-term and long-term in the next 2 to 3 years while you keep trying to contend. Just because Acuna's gone, which sucks, doesn't mean you can't add pieces that are going to help even going into next year. And Peterson, because the outfield is so unsettled with Ozuna, with Pache, with Acuna being out, you make this kind of deal because even if it doesn't put you back into contention without Acuna this year, guess what? He's probably going to be around next year. And that's great because they are going to need veteran bats that they know what they're getting. They needed somebody like this to fill this spot, and I love the Jock Peterson trade. What do you think, Max?
Yeah, I think it's important for one, you know, first reason because it signals sort of their intent here, which is not to tear it down, not to just give up, not to throw their hands up.
Giving us a reason to watch the rest of these games this fall.
Yeah, it's like it would be such a demoralizing, like adding insult to injury if you know Acuna goes down, which is just I don't think we've had a podcast since then. That's devastating. In so many ways, but you don't have to like throw your hands up and punt. And in doing so, you also like if they had just torn it down, I don't like they would have probably sold pieces that would have, you know, possibly helped them next year. And like in years they're trying to contend. And it's just like, that's not what a contending team should do. Even, you know, especially a contending team that's what, 4 games out first place. Like,
yep.
I like them living in this middle space of like, we're not going to do anything that's going to sacrifice the future in terms of giving up massive assets, but we're also not going to just throw our hands up and sell.
And kind of screw Albies and Freeman, right? And Austin Riley, like, who are putting in serious work. Yeah. Albies being an all-star, like, hey, thanks for being awesome this year. Here's a good player that's going to keep this thing afloat so that the season's not for nothing.
Yeah, I mean, this team can still make the playoffs. I mean, as crazy as that sounds, after the Acuna injury, I'm not at all that they're going to make the playoffs. But this is also an important thing because it signals to Freddie Freeman that you're still willing to invest in this team in the here and now. Because Freddie Freeman, he wants to sign a contract. I think that was made like blatantly obvious following his comments at the All-Star game. He wants to be in Atlanta. He wants to be a Brave. But the thing is, you're Liberty Media, you need to show him that you are committed to this team. You're committed to making this roster a winner, and you're not just going to give up. Because if they just come out and give up, that signals that this team is Liberty Media is not invested. And if I'm Freddie Freeman, this is probably the last major contract that I'm going to sign before I just go maybe sign like some veteran contract somewhere else, like an Albert Pujols style thing. But the guy wants to win, and this team is set up to win. You just got to put a couple pieces together to make it a winner. And maybe this Jock Peterson signing is something for people can bring him back next year. I think it's just as the 1 year deal. That he's
but you can bring him back. Like you,
yeah, but that's what I'm saying. It's like you get him there and then you
like
bring
win
him
with
back.
Him. Yeah. And just add him in your plan.
And see
like,
how he fits. Mm-hmm. See how he fits. But look, I mean, the Braves, they're not going to make the playoffs, but the thing is you need to signal Freddie Freeman that, hey, we're committed to winning. You need to do it here with us.
I don't know. And I think we can't rule it out. We can't rule the playoffs out.
Oh, I'm not going to rule them out completely. I'm really optimistic, and I don't think that's the goal anymore. Well, the goal, I mean, obviously the goal is to make the playoffs, but the World Series, like, that's obviously not the goal anymore. It can't be. Yes, I'm sorry. Like, we're not – without Ronald Acuña, I mean, shit.
It's kind of crazy that Chase sounds more optimistic after the Acuña injury than he was before. It was like the roles were flipped here. It was like Chase was all doom and gloom, and Garrett was like, now come on, this team's winning the division.
Dude, I'm a hopeless optimist to my core, and God.
Well, I've been so cynical about the way Atlanta's operated over the last year that them trading for Peterson was a welcome sight. Like, maybe I'm just riding the high of them just being like, we're not going to do the cynical thing and just trade Morton and Smith and just fade away into obscurity the rest of this season. I think it's good, and it means that they might not even trade Morton. Like, they might just hold on to him for this postseason push. I think there is something where you don't want to have that in the locker room, where you don't want to have that in the clubhouse of just being like, yeah, our front office just quit on us because we lost our best player. None of us matter. It's just Acuna. And if he goes down, then the season goes down. And I think that's a bad thing to send and signal to your guys. I don't know. I just think that this is cool. I mean, we're still probably going to get Pache and Waters at some point and see how that all looks. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I think this is the kind of thing, I hope they're not done. I would still like for them to call about Jermaine Marquez in Colorado. I would like to see what they could do there. I mean, Brian Reynolds is an all-star with Pittsburgh and still would love to see that. You can be more active. Like, you can...
What about Chris Bryant,
they're not doing.
You don't think so? I don't think so.
Did you like Joe Buck asking about the trade stuff, the All-Star game? His Bryant's dad
watch.
Was...
I watched until I watched Shohei Ohtani and I watched Freddie Freeman hit and I turned it off.
Well, Bryant's dad was upset about it. Like, they asked Chris Bryant about the trade stuff.
Oh, why... Oh, I didn't read into
it. Yeah, it's
that,
just not the place.
Why the hell would you do something like that? Come on, celebrate the here and now.
Yeah.
I don't know. Joe Buck, every now and then. I mean, he's a great broadcaster. Sometimes that guy rubs me the wrong way.
Garrett, would you trade Charlie Morton after acquiring Jock and seeing what they're doing at the moment? Would you sell high on Charlie, or would you ride this out and go for the postseason with Charlie Morton as your number one?
If the offer's... then I'm trading Charlie. I mean, I don't think anybody, he's not far from untradeable. But I mean, like, Ian Anderson just went to the IL again. He's on the 10-day IL.
I'm worried about Anderson.
I'm getting a little worried about Anderson because, I mean, but, and then Soroka's coming back next year, hopefully.
Okay, I'm not doing that either. It's over. Like, I'm not doing the, I'm penciling in Mike Soroka as a...
Well, I'm not penciling him in. I'm not doing that again, but... No, I mean, but the thing is, it's like Morton is not necessarily, he's not part of this team's future. Mm-hmm. So the thing is, it's like he of the pitching staff, like he is probably the most expendable by far. It's him and Smiley, obviously, because those guys aren't a part of the future of this team. So if somebody's willing to make an offer that will make the Braves organization better, then I'm going to say yes. I mean, because I'm not married to him. Like I'm not going to keep him around because it's like this team isn't winning World Series. I just don't see how that's possible unless they're barring some incredible like second half turnaround that nobody saw coming. I just really don't see that. So yeah,
but I'm just happy. Maybe the biggest question. Thing is like I love watching Braves baseball, and I was kind of bummed that like with Acuna just being gone, that I would just have no reason to watch them, and then it'd be like almost a year before I can enjoy them again. You know, because it's every year's precious, man, and baseball seasons are long, and they're you put a lot of time into them. And
so then, are you opposed to trading Morton then? Like, are you just like I
think you can do two things. I think you could. It depends on what they trade him for. Like if they trade Morton, but also acquire an arm that is under team control for a couple of years, like a Marquez or even a Kyle Gibson or something, I'm okay with it. Like if they can, I think two things can happen where they can trade Morton for pieces in the farm system for the next couple of years. They can also acquire a controllable arm who will help them going into next year when Morton's gone. See what I'm saying? Like I'm okay with trading Morton, but I think they still need to add another arm, especially with Anderson dealing with what he's dealing with.
Yeah, and if like, you know, what if the game plan is to trade Morton, pick up some assets in order to fully go big game hunting this offseason? Like, and if that's the plan, then it's like,
who wouldn't sign on to that?
Like,
that would be very interesting. I don't know what you'd get. I don't know if you'd really get like a big prospect that would, or not big prospect, but even like,
no, but you just,
I don't know who you'd really get from Morton though. Because
prospect depth is important in those deals.
Of course,
it's not just about the A-listers, and it's like it's about sort of who's the second, third, fourth guy in a big trade.
Yeah,
I mean, well, I think there are going to be a lot of suitors. I think that if you look at the Yankees right now, I think they are looking for it. You're looking like the Red Sox have gotten a lot out of. Remember this guy? Like it's a hodgepodge of dudes, but Charlie Morton feels like a Boston Red Sox guy. there's just if you look around the league. I mean, I'm sure with Bauer being gone, and I don't think we see Bauer again this year in Los Angeles, like the Dodgers make a bunch of sense, and we know what their pipeline's like. Like I would not be opposed to calling the Dodgers about Morton. There are teams that will make the trade for Morton, even the A's if they really think they can catch the Astros, or just the Astros themselves. Like we know that they like Morton, he's been there. There'll be options for Charlie Morton.
See, I don't think they're necessarily going to shop him. So, but I think they will be willing to field calls on him. Because I don't know, that's my two cents on it. I just think they're going to, because they know what they have here, and the thing is, like, if they go off and win the division, great. And I think you having Morton in the organization makes you obviously more likely to win the division this year. So I think they'll field calls. I don't think they shop. I'm not going to shop them around. But also, one last thing on Jock Peterson: where do y'all see him batting in the lineup? Where do you put him?
I mean, one or two, right?
I would think in the one spot, but I mean, he could also. I could see him jump into that four, okay. Potentially, maybe. I don't know. One could be interesting though.
I would probably start at one and see what happens.
Well, because who else do we have? Ozzy.
I don't like Ozzy at one. We've seen that before.
Dansby's terrible at the one.
Oh, absolutely not.
I don't really know who else would bat lead off for us. Because we've tried so many different things. Like we tried Ender and Ciarte.
No. Do not put that in the universe. No.
You never know. I just know for a fact Snicker is going to throw in someone who just has absolutely no business being in the leadoff spot there.
He tried that for how many months was that? How many months was Ender
and Ciarte? That was a square peg into a round hole when he has Ronald freaking Acuna. It's like, dude, what are you doing? Just put him in the one spot. Move on.
I hated that.
Oh god, that was terrible.
Oh wait, what's Jordan Schaefer up to? Can we get Jordan Schaefer back?
Maybe we get Marcus Giles or something while we're at it. You know?
Yeah, there you go. last thing, our Atlanta Hawks season's over. It's gonna be quiet on the Hawks front outside of draft stuff. So I think we should dive into draft stuff with where they'll be drafting and what the options are there. But I did want to quickly ask you guys about John Collins' market. We'll be talking about that a bunch this offseason with the Hawks. But in terms of the four teams that have been already listed as teams that are going to come calling about the restricted free agent, Mr. Collins, the Heat, the Mavericks, the Spurs, and the Timberwolves. Of those four, who do you think is going to be the most serious, Max, about John Collins' services?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot here.
man, with a free agent, like you have to imagine the Mavericks have, because the free agency class is like very, it's, you know, John Collins might be the, you know, if Kawhi opts in, I'm trying to think of the other names. John Collins might be like the most gettable top free agent out there. And if you're trying to think of like which of those teams is most desperate to make a splash, it's got to be the Mavericks. I don't know what kind of offer sheet they can put together. I think part of this is like, you know, when you put these restricted free agency offers together, it's like, how do you put as many poison pills in here as possible to like make Atlanta not match?
But then you also have to pay them that.
Right. So it's like you're walking the tightrope here. But I think that Mavericks franchise is so desperate to surround Luka with someone. And so, it's hard. It's early to say which I'm most worried about. I will say I'm getting warmer and warmer to the idea that if like a crazy offer comes in, that you can just let him walk. I go back and forth on that probably every week. But it just seems like given the free agency market, he's going to get a contract that he is like that is above market value for a guy like him. But I reserve the right to pull that take back.
Well, I think the plan is to overpay for Collins to keep him so that you can flip him later and you don't lose him for nothing unless you do a sign and trade. But like Collins is going to get a contract that is not not conducive to like, how can I frame this? Collins is not going to get the kind of contract that you can have in the books and win an NBA championship. Like, I don't think he is going to get the kind of money that like the best thing about John Collins is like if he was a vet, if he was already in the Jay Crowder stage of his career, right, where he saw himself in that light of just like one of the key veteran cogs on a good team, like he's someone you want to go to war with. Like Collins is someone like Jay Crowder has never made a three, but people just think Jay Crowder's a shooter because he shoots threes. He just never makes any of them.
Didn't he make like six in game three?
Pull it up, dude. He is like a 28% career 3-point shooter. Like he is awful all the time from three. He misses more than he takes. And Collins is like one of those where it's like the number, like he'll have the 20 and 14s and he knows what he's doing. He'll have the crazy offensive rebound games, but he's okay. He gets left open in the corner. He'll hit his corner threes, but like Collins is, he's fine. He's a role player. Like he is someone you want. He can be on the floor among your five in an NBA final situation, but he can also, he needs to be like the fourth or fifth highest paid player, or maybe even the sixth. And I don't think Collins is at that point because he's young. He wants to set himself up for life. He wants to get the money. He wants to see what happens. That's all great. Like, I understand where he's coming from with all of that. It's just not conducive because the Hawks have too many guys waiting in the wings. And I was talking to Mike Prada, formerly of SB Nation and now of Limited Upside, about this on Tuesday, was that like the thing about the Hawks is they're going to be like the buck is going to come due for paying Gallinari and Bogdan last summer. Like, this is going to be one of the part of the fallout of going all in last summer and filling up that cap space is the tough questions with John Collins. And he will not be the last tough question they have to answer. And I'm curious to see how Schlenk operates because it's going to be tough. Like, Lou Williams wants a multi-year deal. You're not getting a multi-year deal. Also, you're not paying a backup point guard a multi-year deal. That's insanity. You are not doing that.
He's also not coming back, so that's, we don't have to worry about that. But yeah. Jake, I just want the record to reflect that Jay Crowder shot 38.9% from three this year and is shooting 46% from three in the finals.
No, hold on. So, I'm saying career.
I was about to say career. Yeah,
I'm saying career.
You can shoot it. He's a career 34.5.
Okay, so he's below league average.
In the playoffs.
I'm just saying.
He was 29% last year. He was 29% last year. He was 29% in Memphis.
We don't have to litigate Jay Crowder.
He was 31% in Utah. He was 32% in Cleveland. He was 32% in Toronto.
In Miami.
He was 29% in Dallas. No, majority of his career is a 28% in Boston. Like, the majority of his career has been flirting with that. And then he'll have the crazy heat stroke years where it's like, 46% 1 year and or 36% 1 year in Boston. But like, by and large, it's been mostly bad. He's mostly a bad 3-point shooter.
It's average. He's average.
No, average is 35. He's rarely hit 35.
He's 34.6 for his career. That's average.
He was a particularly bad 3-point shooter like at the beginning of his career when he didn't really shoot him. So that's that's one thing. But I think the dichotomy here is that like the Hawks' long-term future probably does not involve John Collins at you know, pick a number, 27, 26, whatever, $25 million a year on the books. Like, that's probably not the long-term roster construction of the Hawks, and we know that. But it's also, like, if you learn anything from the NBA, it's that you don't – like, the Hawks could match any deal, basically, and he's still an asset. And so, like, you don't – at 23 years old, like, you just don't – and it rarely works out that you let an asset walk for nothing and, like, make out better in the long run. And like we learned that with the, you know, we learned that firsthand with the Kings and Bogdanovich. Like, you just don't let a guy like that go for nothing. And so if it means matching at a number you're probably not super comfortable with and dealing with it later, like, that's probably the smart way to go. But the long term roster construction here, like, you know, it's a question that will come up sooner than, you know, sooner than later, basically.
There's also the question about, like, what sort of impact. I mean, obviously, this is not a tangible thing, but it's like, what sort of impact does he have on that locker room? Because I know you guys definitely read that being, like, he was what do you call it? What was he called? The vibe master in chief or something,
mm-hmm.
or vibe master, whatever, executive vibe
chief
officer,
vibes
whatever.
Officer or something,
yeah. Vibes, something like that, something vibes, whatever. But it's like that kind of thing is kind of an important aspect to a locker room. You know, and I don't know what that would do necessarily to the locker room if he does end up walking. He's also 23 years old. He's 23 years old. He's a leader of a already very young basketball team. So we don't know how much more he could continue to develop. And we had Brian Scalabrine on maybe like a week ago, and he says, like, one of the biggest concerns of a 23-year-old who is at the back end of a first round or something like that and was never looked at to be that guy necessarily is that what happens when he gets paid? And it's never a fair question to ask in my opinion, but at the same time, I mean, Scalabrine asked it, and so I've been thinking about it. What happens when John Collins gets paid? Does he still have that chip on his shoulder? Does he still push in the same way that he had? Does he actually get better next year, or does he fall back? Because that does happen with some professional athletes. I also don't think that's always a fair question to ask, but because you don't know the general makeup of that person. But
we also just got to really move a lot of resources over for the Cam Supermax. So that is something we have to, keep in the forefront, guys.
No, but as someone driving, you know, speaking to you, as someone driving the Cam Reddish bandwagon, like, the development of Cam Reddish would be improved quite a bit if John Collins wasn't on the team next year. Mm-hmm. Just in terms of,
well, I think Hunter more than Collins. I would say,
yeah,
Hunter,
you
could
put DeAndre Hunter into the four, and then
you could play both of them with either Bogdanovich or Herder, or with either Bogdanovich or Herder. You know,
Cam doesn't really matter because Cam will be guarding whoever the best player offensively on the other team will be. So it's like what position he plays doesn't really matter as much because Cam is just going to guard whoever.
Both of them could.
And then you're just putting him out in the corner for a lot of offensive possessions. Like, Cam's just a wing who can guard 1 through 5. Like, but we saw the off the dribble stuff.
Still a minutes crunch. You know, there's still minutes. You know, finite number of minutes to go around.
This team could be very good next year. I'm just sitting here thinking, if this team is healthy, this team is going to be very good. If it's healthy, this team is going to be very good, very very good. I think it's going to be a top three team in the East.
Are we talking draft on this episode, or are we waiting on that?
Let's wait on that.
Okay.
I want to do a deep dive on that. And what do you mean?
I've gotten really excited.
That disappointment was palpable, man. I felt that.
It's a deep draft, man. Like,
I agree.
Well, I mean, if you want to talk about Keon Johnson or Jaden Springer, I'm more than welcome.
I would love your insight there.
Where are we picking? What's our actual draft spot? I haven't actually looked into any of this.
20.
They'll both be gone. Maybe Springer will be there. Who knows? Springer might be there.
I gotta freshen up on some late round.
Is the G League already over? Because Ignite just lost Brian Shaw to the Clippers, like, immediately. Like,
yeah, it's over.
Like, that was the whole thing, was bringing in Brian Shaw to make this a thing, and then he's just gone.
That's all, like, a one-year thing. I mean, all the young guys are there 1 year.
Well, so no, what I'm saying is I wonder now with NIL being a thing, where it's like, if you're Jonathan Kuminga or whoever, Jalen Green, like, I can just go get paid now at UCLA. I would rather just go make a lot of money on endorsements. Like, live where you were living and playing with the G League Ignite. Just go to USC with the facilities and get paid and just be on TV all the time, because no one's watched Jalen Green play a second of basketball yet, and he's in contract. No, like,
I haven't watched a minute of G League, but I would watch him if he played at UCLA.
Exactly.
This NIL stuff is fantastic. I love it. These kids
the
are finally
all these guys get nitpicked when they go to college, and like no one's seen Jalen Green play, but he's about to go second in the draft.
True. But Cade Cunningham
the people who matter have watched him.
Right? I don't think Jalen Suggs goes top five without his season at Gonzaga.
But okay, Josh Christopher, a 5-star, top 10, whatever guy, went to Arizona State, had a mediocre year, and is going to be a second rounder. So it goes both ways.
That's true. That is true. All right, guys, that's all I've got today. Anything you would like to plug as we wrap up here on our Friday Atlanta Sports, guys?
Oh, man, I get to go on vacation tomorrow.
Oh, are you going to be back for the pod next week?
Oh, yeah. It's only like, I'm back on Sunday because I have to work.
Oh, that's a short vacation.
Oh, yeah. No, I leave.
We call that the weekend, like actually. I think Garrett's misunderstanding what the weekend is.
Bro, I haven't worked. I haven't not worked a full weekend in God knows how long. At least this year.
Max, what about you?
Nothing to plug. Hawks in 7.
Hawks top 3 seed in the Eastern Conference. Book it.
Hawks 62 wins next year.
Oh my God.
Bet. Let's go.
Oh my God. All right. For that guy, Max Markovich, and that other Atlanta sports guy, Garrett Chapman, and for myself, Chase Thomas, that is all we've got. We'll be back as we are every single Friday. So go like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. Just Google Atlanta Sports Guys. We'll come up. I promise. Thank you as always. And we'll be back next week. All right. Welcome back to the Chase Thomas Podcast. Boys and girls, I'm still the aforementioned Chase Thomas. And joining me, as always, is my good friend, fellow University of North Georgia alumni, Matt Green. Sir, how are you?
Doing excellent, sir. It's a Friday. It's a little different than the Thursday I'm used to.
Yeah,
so I hope I'm still as sharp, you know, ready for the weekend.
That's good, man. I'm happy. Can you tell that I'm recording in a different studio?
No, I can't. Where you at?
The lady and I. I have a place, so I am recording in my new studio office. In the northern part of Knoxville, the lady. So, got a new setup in the new digs.
Very nice.
You're not the only one doing the whole let's make a life and have a dog. And I gotta match the dog. Like I gotta match it. You've encouraged me, Matt Green, to take that next step with
the American
girlfriend.
Dream.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, man, it's good.
I'm in suburbia, you know, but if you're in Knoxville, it's not like a huge city, but it's a respectable city. So are you a suburbanite? Are you a city dweller, if you will?
Mostly city, because like downtown Knox is 2 minutes from our house. So, I would say not suburbia. The way I describe it is this house reminds me a lot of where I was living for several years in downtown Atlanta after undergrad. So the Virginia Highlands. This is like Virginia Highlands, where it's like right off downtown Atlanta. You know what I mean? That's what I would describe.
Oh, man, a little humble brag there.
Living in
the
humble
Virginia
brag.
Highlands, no big deal.
What?
It's a nice area, of Atlanta. No?
It's going through some stuff. Well, also, I will say, it is nice for people who buy, but like my rent was like $600 a month. It was not... It's not crazy. It was an older house.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was. I'll never find that again.
In Atlanta, you probably were not living you weren't living the high life then.
Well, I was having 3 roommates. So it was just a house, 4 dudes and that. So the landlord was doing all right. But it was good. It was a good situation for a long time.
That's the dream right there, man. I just want to be a landlord.
Is that what you want to be?
Like, honestly, at this point, I feel like passive income, man. That's where it's at. Like, I just want to own. We after we're done with this, just get our next house and just keep owning this and then rent it out. Like that would be sick. Just keep making some money. I'm tired of working for money. Like that's what poor people do. They work for their money. The wealthy people, they just collect the money. Like I want to be one of those people.
Matt clearly had a tough week at the mysterious day job. That's great. That's great. Or you could just do like, you can just do the whole entrepreneurial stuff. You could do all that.
True.
Well, we got some topics to hit today. We got Sporting News released their top 150 head coaching rankings. We got the transfer portal top 150 coming to us from 247 Sports. We got Nebraska getting a new AD and the legend Frank Solich stepping down, unfortunately, from the Ohio Bobcats. Maction will never be the same due to health concerns. And then we watched 2009 Oregon versus Oregon State for this week's recap of a great game from the college football lore. Matt, where do you want to start?
I guess we'll start with the headlines, right? You want to leave that game for last, or you just want to jump into that throwback?
Let's leave that game for last. Let's do headlines first. Let's do Frank Solich stepping down from Ohio. This is a bummer. Like, he's been quietly just put together great program. Like, it feels like forever ago that he was competing with the big boys with Nebraska, back when Nebraska was good and still competing. He has just been hiding out in I think it's Athens, Ohio. I want to say
it is Athens, Ohio.
Great run for Frank Solich, right?
Yeah, definitely. They've been a respectable program in recent years. On top of,
and can I tell you? Can I give you a Frank Solich stat?
And just how awful Nebraska's been since he left, too.
Can I give you a Solich stat?
Yeah, give me a Solich stat.
He is the winningest coach in MAC history.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they've had a bunch of 9-10 win seasons, or maybe one 10-win season, but a bunch of 9-win seasons, and in the MAC, that's respectable, because you probably have a couple of those paycheck games every year, going to play Michigan or going to play Ohio State or something like that. So 9-4 is basically, that's probably like his average season there. So maybe 8-5. That's big time work he's done for the Bobcats.
So also, he played fullback at Nebraska and was a assistant under Tom Osborne forever as a running backs coach, but he surpassed in his first six seasons at Nebraska the wins of Bob Devaney, who had 53, and Osborne, 55. Both of those guys are in the College Football Hall of Fame. You're familiar with the College Football Hall of Fame, Matt.
Very.
Solich won 58 games in his first six seasons. Like, that dude won and then got moved on. He was fired by the new AD, Steve Peterson. And just to, like, where we know Nebraska is now, Nebraska went 9-4, 12-1, 10-2, 11-2, 7-7, and 9-3 the year he got fired in 2003. Can you imagine? Like, they would kill for that now.
Well, but what's crazy is, like, they made the mistake twice at Nebraska. Like, they fired him after going 9-3. Like, obviously, that was terrible. Like, all the success he had. But they did the same. They turned around, did the same thing to Bo Pelini. Like, he was going like 9-3 every year, and that whole clip came out. I think that was maybe the real reason Bo Pelini got fired, of the, when he was just kind of bashing Nebraska fans for like unrealistic expectations. But yeah, I mean, the Bo Pelini era, he's going 10-4, 10-4, 9-4, 10-4, and he even got fired. Like, I don't know what more Nebraska wanted from what Bo Pelini was doing, and Solich really just had the one down year. So I'm the fact that he's coached for this long since leaving Nebraska, I'm sure they're regretting that decision.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those where you have to adjust your expectations, where you're like, you gotta understand, like, things are good. Stop trying to, like, it may not be exactly what you want, but things could be always be worse, and they have found that in recent years in Nebraska. Well,
and I wonder, like, did they go downhill because they fired Frank Solich, you know, or was it like, I don't know, Nebraska, like, in the modernization of college football, was Nebraska like kind of a ticking time bomb anyway? Like, were they going to go downhill? Because, you know, we haven't seen Nebraska be relevant in years, really. Like, I mean, when was the last time they played for a conference championship? Like, we're going on, shoot, at least probably like 8-9 years, right, since they were even in the Big Ten championship. So it's with with their fan base and everything, it doesn't seem like they should be down for this long, but I don't know, just in the middle of Nebraska, I just don't know how many guys are wanting to come out there.
Well, speaking of Nebraska, they hired a new AD to replace Bill Moose, who's retiring. Trev Albert, little concerned that he's going by Trev, as an adult grown man, cannot be going by Trev. Not
what,
a fan.
Should he go by Trevor?
Yeah.
But he's always been Trev Albert. It's like...
don't like it. Sorry. Trev is a young person. Like, it's a kid name. It's a kid nickname. Your friends can call you Trev.
I respect it. He's a younger AD though, you know. So he's that new blood they're bringing in. But I always liked Trev Alberts when he was on ESPN. Personally, I thought he was always the best one on the set compared to Mark May and Lou Holtz.
Mm. Well, he is going to be appreciated by the Huskers fan base. Like they're in on this guy. They love him igniting just one of the Huskers' greatest runs. I'm not concerned. I guess I'm curious to see what his relationship's like with Scott Frost, who's 12-20 to this point at Nebraska. If they have some sort of connection where he's going to give him more time because he understands, or he's not the one who hires Scott. So does he just look at this year as like a make or break year that they have to really start contending because they have $155 million football complex under construction by Memorial Stadium. They have talent. I mean, you have a good quarterback. Like I'm curious to see if Alberts gives Frost more leniency because of the past, or is just like, nah, we have a lot of money here and we have high donor activity and like we're going to go back to the drawing board to ensure that our expectations are being met because we're Nebraska. I'm curious.
Yeah, I was kind of wondering the same thing because it's almost like a cliche when an AD gets hired, like he's got to get his guy, you know? So Frost is not the guy he hired. So most guys, I don't know, maybe it's just looked at as the AD's legacy of bringing in a big time successful coach. But at the same time, Scott Frost is Nebraska, just like Trev Alberts is a Nebraska guy. So I wonder if that'll help maybe at least buy him a couple years of maybe he understands just how bad of a situation this program is in right now. And it's not going to help anything if we just go ahead and fire another coach. Like, I think we need to take a serious look in the mirror of like, what are our expectations at Nebraska and what does it take to get there? Because just firing your coaches every 4 or 5 years, like that's not going to do anything.
No, but I don't know. There, it does feel like Scott Frost is not gaining the momentum he should be gaining at this point. I think it's fair to, I don't know, question whether or not he is the right guy. Like, it's not even like he's going bowling every year. Like,
I would definitely, yeah. And they've had 5 losing seasons in the last 6 years. So, and 3 of those are Scott Frost. So, I don't know. It's, I feel confident that Scott Frost is a good coach, you know, with his track record at Oregon and what he did at Central Florida. But like you said, like when you're looking at someone like Mike Norvell, like, he's coming in and like he didn't have a good first season, but they're creating a buzz on the recruiting trail now. Like people are talking about Florida State. Like it's showing that like there's some wheels in motion. And Nebraska, like they really haven't changed at all the trajectory they were on since Scott Frost got the job. Other than just being ranked in the AP poll 1 year, I guess because people assumed Scott Frost was gonna get them to the next level, but they haven't really done much.
They have not. Let's get into some topics that we wanted to hit on today before we get into Oregon State. The transfer portal, top 150, most of the dust has settled. A little bit too much Tennessee at the top of this list for my liking, Matt Green, but that is to be expected after the ouster of Pruitt and everyone who moved on from that. Also, Caden Salter ending up at Liberty. That dude is just gonna follow Malik Willis and just be awesome at Liberty. Like, that guy, it's gonna be painful, but had to be done. Heupel's hands were tied, but that's gonna be a bummer. But
you see, Liberty also got a former Georgia receiver, J.J. Holloman, too.
Did he really? I didn't even see that.
Yeah, because he was a, went to FIU, but I think he was sitting out. I don't think he ever even actually played at FIU. I'm not 100% sure about that. But, yeah, he was good for Georgia in 2018. I think that was his freshman or sophomore year. So it'll be interesting. Liberty's got a lot of weapons.
Was Holloman a five-star coming out? I feel like he was, wasn't he?
No, he was like a top 100 recruit, though.
Okay.
He was the one that committed with the whole little Christmas thing they had going on. I don't know if you remember that video that came out. It was like him and Nate McBride, who also didn't really turn into much for Georgia. But it was that first full class that Kirby had with Fromm and Richard LeCount and everything.
Mm. Well, no surprise, Henry Toa being number one at Bama. Probably going to play himself into a first-round pick because of his time in Alabama this fall. Eric Gray at Oklahoma should just be awesome in that system. Your guy, Eric Gilbert, being used as a Swiss Army knife, similar to Kyle Pitts at UGA this fall. But those are the obvious ones. Wandale Robinson, who I'm a big fan of, and what he's going to do at Kentucky going back home there. Who from this list stands out to you? Do you agree with it by and large? You got your guy Tyke Smith in that top 10, but your guy Tyreek Stevenson making the jump to Miami. Who in this list really stands out to you? Because for me, it's Kane Madden. I was doing some tape work on him from Marshall and like what he was doing there. He was second team All-American last year in 2020. And then just going to the offensive line factory that is Notre Dame, I think he's going to be really, really good there. And I think that's a big get for the Fighting Irish to protect their new quarterback under center. What do you think? What names stand out to you?
Well, as far as just individuals go, he's still obviously one of the more unproven guys on this list. But the name that is like the most intriguing to me is DeMarcus Bowman. He didn't even play at Clemson. I think he transferred before the season even started last year. And then now he's going to be at Florida. Five-star from Lakeland, Florida. Just with the lack of running game Florida's had over the last, you know, two or three years under Dan Mullen, like the way that people talk about Dan Mullen, like that's his bread and butter, right? Like that's what he did so well with Dak Prescott, with Nick Fitzgerald at Mississippi State, was just having these dynamic running attacks. And you haven't seen that at all from Florida. I think it kind of speaks to how good of a coach Dan Mullen is to not have the personnel to run the ball well. And, you know, he's just turned him into a very dangerous passing offense. But if this guy is the five-star billing he was supposed to be coming into college, like he's essentially a redshirt freshman right now. And I think that could make Florida so dangerous if they actually have a tailback that scares defenses, because they really haven't, like, the entire time Dan Mullen's been there. When they had when they had the two running backs, it was P. Ryan and somebody else. Like, P. Ryan was fine. Like, he got drafted, but he was nothing special. If they can actually get a running back there that's special, I think running backs are kind of that ultimate kind of, like, scheme breaker. It's like if a running back just is making people miss, like, there's nothing a defense can do to scheme for it. You know what I mean? Like, it's just kind of that ultimate X factor. So I'm really curious to see what Florida gets out of DeMarcus Bowman. But just in terms of looking at this list, like, I think it's very well reported of how much Tennessee lost in the transfer portal. But what's crazy to me is seeing Clemson at number 5, Clemson at number 6, and Clemson at number 7. Like, those are three big pieces for them to lose. And they're all guys that went to big-time SEC programs, LSU, Georgia, and Florida. So Clemson could be lacking some talent. Like, obviously, Clemson's still loaded, but those are some big pieces for a program like that to lose.
Speaking of Tennessee, the Ty Chandler stuff being on this list is silly. Like, that dude is going to do nothing in North Carolina. You can talk about their scheme all you want. Like, I've watched a lot of Ty Chandler in my life. It's not happening in year 27 of his college career. Like, I would not buy a bunch of stock there. But where I do think there is, well, like, if we do a new list at the end of the season to see how this all plays out, I would not be surprised if Mackenzie Bilton's in the top 3 and also Zach Charbonnet. Those two stand out to me in the bottom half of this list because Charbonnet, we only saw a little bit of him at Michigan and because of injuries, but like him and we watched Chip Kelly last night, right? Like we were watching what LaMichael James, we just have seen for so many running backs when Chip Kelly gets his hand on like a, what was his name? Kelly. I forgot his first name. At UCLA, but like he knows how to use running backs in the RPO system. He knows how to do this. And Dorian Thompson Robinson with Charbonnet, I think, has all kinds of opportunity in the Pac-12 South. And I think he has the talent. We saw it in his freshman year that like that dude, you talk about the running back game changer, like you put him in Chip Kelly's system if he's healthy. I think that's going to be huge for him. And I also just think Mackenzie Milton, if he looks like he did in the spring and anywhere close to what he was at UCF years ago, then that's a game changer for Florida State. Like they have not had a difference maker quarterback in so long. It's been since what DeAndre Francois was the last game changer when he was all hyped up against Ole Miss to kick off a season, which feels like forever ago. I think that that's a game changer for them because then you look at Florida State in a completely different light if Mackenzie Milton is what we all expect. And I mean, he's an NIL champion right now, but we'll see what it, if it translates to on the field stuff, but he's just an easy guy to root for. But I could just see him being at number one, number two at the end of the year.
DeAndre Francois was a, that was a deep track right there. Mm. I totally forgot about DeAndre Francois because he really just had that 1 year. And then that year that they opened up with Alabama, like number one versus number two, that was essentially like the start of the downfall of Florida State football. But Joshua Kelly,
that was it, yeah,
the name you were looking for. But yeah, I think in Chip Kelly's system, I could definitely see your boy having some success.
Yeah, but that's all the big ones, I guess, from this list. The next thing I wanted to hit, Matt Green, the top 150 head coaching rankings. I got really upset when
you're
I saw
mad.
This one really bothered me. Like it's bad, Matt Green. Like it's objectively bad. I'm very annoyed. I'm very annoyed about a lot of names on this list and where they are. I don't even know where to start. Where do you, which name stands out to you the most that like, I need someone to explain to me. I want to sit down with the person who put David Cutcliffe in 2021 ahead of Chip Kelly, Justin Wilcox, Kalani Sitake, Jeff Hafley, Billy Napier at 53, Bill Clark at 54. What are we doing? Jeff Monken at 57. What? How? Brett Bielema, just because of what he's done in the past, being at 64 behind Mel Tucker and Mike Locksley. Who? What? What? Matt Wells ahead of just so many. Matt Wells has been a train wreck. Sonny Dykes, I think, is the one that's most offensive to me at 73. There is no way on this planet that Sonny Dykes is the 73rd best head coach in college football. That dude is going to put out a top 25 program no matter what. Like, he wins everywhere. His offense is just like, it doesn't matter what changes and who's in it. That guy wins. That guy is just guaranteed to put SMU and wherever he's coaching in the state of Texas or anywhere in the West on the map. He's down. Just, I don't understand how you do that. And then you have some names. Gary Patterson, the Lifetime Achievement Award at 22. Gross. David Shaw, 24.
I feel like 22 seems right about where Gary Patterson should be. I feel
10
like
years
that,
ago, yes. Not now.
I feel like that 50. Oh, 10 years ago, he was like top five, like top 10. But I'm not nearly as high on you as you are on Chip Kelly. Like what he did at Oregon was amazing, but that's forever ago at this point.
He's coming. You know what I mean? Like this year is huge for him. He took over. I don't think people realize just how much bad shape the UCLA program was when he took it over.
That's fair. But if he has to take that step with UCLA to show that he's like,
we saw a lot of it last year.
Elite coaches in college football. But I felt like Scott Frost at 49.
Yeah, get out of here.
Super generous. Justin Fuente at 51. Like, I don't know how you're putting guys like that ahead of Billy Napier at 53 and Bill Clark at 54. Like, these guys, and you said Jeff Monken, like, these guys are actually having success. Like, Justin Fuente, like, I feel like Virginia Tech, I think Justin Fuente's tenure at Virginia Tech has showed us how not big time Virginia Tech football is. Like, how far they've actually fallen from, like, if the way we grew up, you know, like, I would say, you know, actually being aware of the national sports picture, like, in the 2000s, Virginia Tech was like a top 10 program, like my childhood and early adult life, right? Like Virginia Tech was consistently in the top 10 all the time. Like Justin Fuente has done nothing, but not only that, no one even talks about him not doing anything. It's like they've become that irrelevant. Like at least Jim Harbaugh, it's like at least the seat is heating up. Like people talk about how disappointing it's been. It's like, what are we on? Is this year 5 of Justin Fuente, or we're going on year 6, right?
Yeah.
2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah, we're going on year 6. And like you got a 9-win season and a 10-win season.
It's gotten worse every year.
Exactly. And I'm just not sure. He seems almost like, I don't know, immune to the pressure that some of these other coaches are under.
I mean, I agree. There's a lot. But in the top half, who, like Ed Orgeron, I guess because he won a national title recently, you have to put him in there. Jimbo as well. But like, I don't know. Ryan Day still being in the top 6 with, he's such a hard person to rank right now. He should still get an NR until, but like, Kirby at 7, I guess, is okay, but Matt Campbell, at least he's in the top 10, but 9 seems low. Mac Brown, I think, belongs there. It's kind of wild to see him there. The Mario Cristobal, though, at 16, he's recruiting well.
I'm not sure how he's ahead of any of those. Paul Christ, Mike Gundy, Kyle Whittingham, like Tom Allen, even Kirk Ferentz. Like,
yeah.
I'm not sure what Mario Cristobal has proven to be ahead of any of those guys.
And if you're going to put Mario Cristobal that high, you got to put Manny Diaz that high. Like, I don't know. I almost think that Hugh Freeze probably belongs higher up the list.
I absolutely think Hugh Freeze should be higher on that list. Like 30, like Manny Diaz at 31 too. That's generous.
Well, like what universe is anyone taking Clay Helton over Hugh Freeze?
Yeah, exactly. No, nowhere. Like that's not happening.
Yeah,
I play Helton at 25 is definitely, and I would probably, I might put Lane Kiffin a little bit higher, but 26, that might be about where he should be. Orgeron, I think, is probably the most difficult person to rank because we just literally have no idea how good of a coach he is. Like, I don't even know what his impact on the program is. Like, he seems like a guy who's just the inmates are running the asylum for lack of a better term. Not saying anything about the LSU football players, although there's obviously been some shady things coming out. But like you said, Ryan Day at 6, this top 7, 8, 9 seems pretty consistent with what the majority of college football fans think. Just to refresh people, we got Saban 1, Swinney 2, Riley 3, Kelly 4, Fisher 5. Day 6, Kirby 7, and Mullen 8, Campbell 9, and Mac Brown 10. I just, you know how I feel about Lincoln Riley. I feel like he gets all of the credit with none of the blame. I personally rank Kirby a couple spots above where he's at. We've been through that before. I know this is why these coaching rankings are so difficult, because it's not a career achievement award, but it kind of has to be a little bit, right? Like, Jimbo Fisher's national championship is, we're going on, what, 8 years ago? But he's still one of, like, 4 active coaches to actually, or is it, no, 5 active coaches to actually have a championship. So, like, I don't know how you really rank Brian Kelly ahead of Jimbo Fisher. I don't know how you rank Lincoln Riley. Like, I guess Lincoln Riley, you're at least projecting forward. But for someone like Brian Kelly and Jimbo Fisher, like, they've been around the same amount of time. They've kind of inherited similar programs. Like, I think Notre Dame was definitely worse when Kelly got the job than Florida State was when Jimbo got the job. But Jimbo Fisher seems like a guy that people have such differing opinions on. Like, I personally rank Kirby 3. I think outside of Saban and Dabo, he's the best coach out there. But, like, he's definitely the coach I would want coaching my program behind those two. But I don't argue over Brian Kelly and Jimbo Fisher being ranked ahead of Kirby, because they've legitimately accomplished things over their track record. But Lincoln Riley and Ryan Day, it seems so odd to me to put them both consistently in the top 5, like so many people do, when they're just still so young and fresh and mm-hmm. haven't taken the program to any new heights than it was previously at. And that's partly a disadvantage they have of taking over successful programs. It makes it hard to evaluate. But at the same time, their job is just so much easier that they need to have tangible results to really prove how good they are.
Yeah. Well, let's move to the next thing. Your list, the CBS Sports Hot Seat Rankings. Lay it out for the good folks.
So CBS Sports did the Hot Seat Index, whatever you want to call this, and they just rated them 1 to 5. So 5 is winner be fired. 4 is start improving now. 3, pressure is mounting. 2, all good for now. 1, safe and secure. 0, untouchable. So they had 22 coaches that they gave a 0 rating to, which is just untouchable, which I kind of was surprised at that many coaches being untouchable. But when you see the guys they chose, I could understand that.
Who did they choose?
So I can't go through all of them. They're kind of alphabetical, but there's guys like Saban, Dabo, Jeff Monken is in there, Luke Fickle, Kirby Smart, Tom Allen at Indiana. It's like, that's another one. It's like, you don't really consider him a 0, but it's like, you know, Indiana's not firing him. So that is legit. Like they're going to ride that as long as they can. Then you got Hugh Freeze, Billy Napier, just some of those names, Mac Brown. So it's Pat Fitzgerald. So it's an interesting way to look at it. But I think I was as a Georgia fan, I was delighted to see this list because it feels like there's this artificial exterior pressure being put on Kirby Smart in Georgia. Like they don't win a championship this year. Seat's getting hot. And it's like, no, it's really not. Like Georgia fans desperately want a championship, but they feel confident that Kirby is the guy. And I would say just from talking to Georgia fans that I know, like his seat couldn't be cooler. You know what I mean? Even though there is a lot of that pressure, it's like that the pressure existed before Kirby got there. It's not specifically on him. It's just the people of Athens, Georgia won a championship more than anything. You know what I mean?
I've heard that they're in on the whole national title situation. I've heard that that is something that they want.
It just, the thing that irritates me is that people say like, this is the year for Georgia, right? If
Georgia doesn't get irritated about this every time it comes up, like you, I
get irritated because at the same time they rank them 5th. Like, have you seen one poll that has Georgia higher than like 3rd or 4th? Like I haven't seen one.
Almost, I think it's because everyone wants to put them at 1, but everyone's terrified of putting Georgia 1.
But it's like, that's what you think, if you project them to be the best team, put them at 1. Like, that's what the whole purpose of the preseason ranking is. It's like, oh, they got to win a championship this year. Oh, so they're 1, right? Oh, no, they're 5. Like, well, what? Well, why is this the year they have to win a championship if you don't even think they're 1? Like, it's just a strange logic to me. But there's 3 coaches that they listed at a 5, which is win or be fired. Do you think you can guess those 3 coaches?
Win or be fired. What qualifies as win or be fired? Like 6-7 games? Like what state of the programs are they in right now? When you say win, like win a title or win to get them out of like the gutter? What is?
I would say most of these are to get them out of the gutter, just looking at the specific coaches. But it's also different programs have different standards, right? Like,
okay, you got to give me the conferences.
Okay, so we got 1 Big Ten. We got... Shoot, I think they're independent now. Honestly, I should know this as a college football person.
Okay.
But former Big East team. I think they're independent.
Okay, so Randy Etzel, Scott Frost.
That is correct. Both of those are correct. And then there's 1 more you got.
And UConn is independent now. What was the other conference?
ACC.
ACC. Dave Doran?
Justin Fuente.
Oh, Justin Fuente, yeah.
So they had him as a 2 last year, and now he's at a 5. So, and they had Chip Kelly as a 5 last year, and now he's at a 3. So what's interesting is they had Randy Edsel at a 5 last year, and he's still there. So this list might lose a little credibility. But yeah, and Scott Frost they had as a 5 last year, and he's still at a 5. So I'm... Scott Frost, like I want to like Scott Frost. I think it's just inevitable that Nebraska is not going to be back this year. And I just feel like if that's what their standards are, like he's probably losing his job.
I mean, they have talent. Like, there is all kinds of talent. Losing Wandale Robinson is going to hurt. But, like, if Adrian Martinez pops, like, that dude is – he has all the tools. Like, there is – the key has a Heisman-type player under center. Like, if he puts it all together. Like, the tools are there. But we shall see. We shall see.
Just to give you a couple more zeros on this list, though, do you agree with Kyle Whittingham and Paul Chryst both being a zero?
Yes.
I would agree with Whittingham. I guess Chryst, I don't know. Wisconsin's an interesting job in that respect. But also you got Bill Clark. I would agree with that one. But two I thought were strange. I definitely would not list him as a zero. It would be Gary Patterson and
Oh,
David
yeah, no,
Shaw.
Definitely not a zero. They have him at
like,
zero?
I mean, they got a statue for Patterson, but like...
Do they really?
Yeah, he's like one of... I think there's like three head coaches that had statues for... Actually, I think it's only two now because Bill Snyder's retired. But yeah, there's a statue for him at outside TCU's stadium. But
weird.
I just don't think it's a zero. Like TCU has been kind of going in the wrong direction for a while now.
Yeah, I don't like
and then,
that.
And then Stanford, I personally don't really understand the obsession with David Shaw. Like, he kind of inherited the good program that Harbaugh established. And it seems like they've just kind of been on a slow decline ever since. Like, they had a couple good years when he first took over. I guess he had more good years than I was giving him credit for. But they just seem like they've been on a slow decline for the last, you know, 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, no, Shaw, I actually agree with. And that's like, because he still recruits. Like, remember he got David Mills out of GAC, like a 5-star kid. Like, he still recruits high level guys, and like the offensive line and the defense is usually solid. But it is weird that they've kind of fallen off. And like, he was the hot name to get the Jets job or whoever for several years. And now it's just, in the Pac 12, it's not like he's dealing with the SEC or even just the Big Ten. Like, he is in a very winnable conference every year. Like, Stanford, like, that should be an opportunity for them because the Pac-12 is just down, and they have not taken advantage of a down Pac-12 as a good elite coach should. If you have a zero on your ranking, you should be taking advantage of the state of this Pac-12.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Well, let's get into our rewatch this week, Matt Green. We watched Oregon State from 2009. The one thing I'd forgotten about is who the actual quarterback was for Oregon State. I remember Masoli, I remember James, I remember Mahaly, the wideout for Oregon. I remember Kiki Alonso coming onto the scene.
Yeah, I was expecting to see, like, was it Sean Mannion a few years ago?
Yes.
But like, I did not remember. What was it? Is it Sean Canfield? I had never even heard of that guy, to be honest.
And he was a lefty, which was great, but super accurate. Jesse Palmer was salivating over this broadcast, like just really, really all in on average white quarterback who doesn't make mistakes and throws complete 70% of his passes. Like, Jesse Palmer found his Pac-12 quarterback comp, but he was solid. But this game was like, there was a crazy quizzy run, or I guess it was a screen midway through the second that ended up being a field goal, I recall, for the Beavs.
I was a huge Jock Quiz Rogers fan.
That dude is just a bowling ball. Like, it was, so much fun to watch. And then, like, there's some stuff with LaMichael James where if you look at the box score, it won't tell you the full story because he ended the game with 25 carries, 166 yards, and 6.6 yards per carry and 3 TDs. He got bottled up by this Oregon State defense most of the night. Like, halfway through the first, like, I think it was the whole first half, he really had nothing.
I was thinking the same thing. You could see kind of why he wasn't an NFL running back after mm-hmm. watching this game. Like, I mean, he was ridiculously productive in college, and he did nothing in the NFL. And it's because they were basically running the triple option, you know, and that's not the running lanes you run through in the NFL.
This game had high stakes. Is this the highest stakes Civil War of all time? Like, the winner was going to the Rose Bowl to play Ohio State. Like, that's kind of wild. Like, when was the last time that was going to be a thing? Mike Riley, man, he deserves a statue outside of Oregon State for putting that in that spot.
I figured you were going to bring that up, that of like the good old days of like the season finale decided who wins the Pac-10 and goes to the Rose Bowl. Like, that was a great time. So much drama, you know, but unfortunately those games are never going to happen anymore, especially with the expanded playoff.
Yeah. It is,
but unfortunate. Honestly, I legit forgot about LeGarrette Blount until I saw him come in. I was like, oh wow, this was that year that he had the 10 game suspension after he punched the Boise State player. Yes. And everything, like, that was wild.
That was a wild night. I remember that night and just texting friends about that. I was just like, did you see what LeGarrette, like, that was a wild time. What were your other takeaways? What did you think of Masoli in this game?
Masoli was a real throwback for sure. That was I smiled once I saw Jeremiah Masoli. I was just kind of like, oh, this is that era. Okay, I now know where we are. But the dude he ran so hard for a quarterback, and that run at the very end that kind of sealed the win, just straight trucked that defensive player. But I saw this article that came up from 2019 that it said, like, Masoli's bulldozing run essentially sent these two programs on opposite paths. And it was kind of crazy. You look at it, like, since this game, because Oregon State also actually lost the bowl game this year, I think, like, the Las Vegas Bowl or something. And so they didn't finish ranked. And so since this game, Oregon State has finished ranked one time, and that in the last 12 years. And right after this season, like, Oregon just took off. Like, in the next 5 years, they had four top 10 to top five finishes, like, five straight top 10 finishes. Like, Oregon just took off after, I wouldn't say it was this game, but it literally was after this game. It was just a streak of just Oregon becoming, like, the sexiest team in college football.
Well, you can't win them all. You can't win them all. Oregon State.
For sure.
Yeah, Mike Riley, like, him moving on for Nebraska was not the best move for him. I guess it's you want to take those shots because it's Nebraska, and if you revitalize them and win there, it's just the fan base is just different than in Corvallis. But he had a good thing going in Oregon State, and Oregon State hasn't figured it out. Jonathan Smith building something, but Oregon State had it good during the summer. And also James Rogers, the Rogers brothers were just so much fun, and James Rogers was just a yak machine. Him and Quizzy, just yak machines. And I don't know, it was just interesting to see how this game worked too, because of how different they played. Like, there was a very pro style, slow and steady, we'll do some jet sweeps with James Rogers, but, like, we are going to do those quick comeback routes. We're gonna do the NFL stuff with our very average quarterback who does not take chances downfield. And Oregon's like, RPO, 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 jet sweep, reverse, deep bomb. Like, it was interesting to see the different identities on offense between these two teams, because it could not be any more stark when you're watching, and you're just like, the motion is different. Everything was different about Oregon versus Oregon State.
For sure. And it's just a completely different era. Like, just looking at their two schedules, like, Oregon State played four ranked teams, two top 10 teams. Oregon played five ranked teams, two top 10 teams. Like, this was just a much healthier version of the Pac-10. Version of the Pac-12, because this was the Pac-10.
Mm. What was your favorite announcing moment from this game?
I don't think I had. One thing kind of tripped me out was that recording we were watching was ESPN Classic. So, like, I feel like, just growing up when we did, like, you can't not just look at the bottom line while you're watching a game, you know?
Yeah.
And so this game is from 2009, but the bottom line is from 2012. It was totally throwing me off. I was like, wait, what? Georgia and Alabama in the SEC championship? It was kind of funny, but I didn't have any thoughts necessarily about the announcers.
I thought it was weird. Was this a group? I don't remember Fowler and Palmer doing this. Where was Herbie?
This could be before Fowler really got those real big time games. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, before he was really doing, like, the ABC national game of the week, I guess.
Yeah. That must be what it is. That's interesting. But yeah, there you go. And the good history nugget about the fall of the program after this game. I also think Mario Cristobal, like, this iteration of Oregon was just so exciting, and they were just must see television. And I understand, like, it ran its course, but, like, the difference now, I'm watching Oregon now playing, like, Alabama, it's not as fun. Like, it will help come playoff time, but I do miss this iteration of Oregon, because if you watch them now, like, it's just bad offense. Like, they were bad, objectively bad on offense last year, and they're just not an offense first team. They're a defense first team. Matt Green, do you have anything that you would like to add as we wrap up here on this different Friday edition of the pod.
That's all I got, sir.
All right. For that guy, Matt Green, down there in Tequila, Georgia. For myself, Chase Thomas, up here in Knoxville, Tennessee. That is all the time that we have today. Until next time, be good to each other, folks. Thanks, Matt Green.
Later.
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc. Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.